Women have been giving birth for centuries, so it's a pretty natural experience, right? Wrong. I'm Stephanie King, professional doula, childbirth educator, and the creator of the My Essential Birth course, the online childbirth education course that's helping women everywhere confidently achieve their best birth. Today's culture would have us think that birth should be treated like an illness or an emergency, and that most of us need other people telling us what's best for our bodies because we aren't the experts. So sit tight, because if you're tuning into this podcast, you'll probably start to believe in your body, your intuition, and find yourself empowered and confident to do what it takes to have the birth of your dreams. If you like listening to me take you through these weekly topics step by step, then you're going to love the My Essential Birth course. Make sure that you're subscribed to the podcast and definitely head over to myessentialbirth.com for the free downloads mentioned right here in these episodes and to join the birth course and community full of pregnant moms just like you. I have to add a disclaimer that I am not a medical professional and I cannot provide medical advice. All of the information expressed in this podcast are based off of personal, professional, and educational experiences and are my own opinions. Please work with a provider you trust for medical advice during your pregnancy and birth. As a bonus, to say thank you for listening to this episode and to make sure that you guys are hopefully getting just everything you can possibly desire out of it when it comes to prenatal nutrition, I want to take a moment and tell you I am giving away a copy of Real Food for Pregnancy to go along with this episode. I have read it myself, as you hear me talk about in the episode. I not only have the paper copy, I have Lily in my ear with the audiobook listening. All you have to do in order to get a copy of this book, I'm going to give it away to one lucky listener, is leave a review for the Pregnancy and Birth Made Easy podcast. So if you've never done that before, so you head to Apple Podcasts, you find Pregnancy and Birth Made Easy, scroll down, hit those 5 stars, click write a review, and then put your information in and then screenshot or send me a copy paste of the review that you sent because it takes a couple days to get up. And I will do this giveaway the next Monday following the release of this episode. So thank you all for listening. Thank you for the reviews. You guys keep coming back. These episodes just keep getting better. And it's going to be such an awesome episode for you to listen to today. So enjoy. All right, guys, welcome back to this week's podcast. And our reviewer of the week is ATAP123. She says, my favorite pregnancy podcast. I only wish I found this podcast earlier. I found this podcast at 37 weeks and have faithfully listened to an episode a day. Helped me remember so many things about birth that I forgot about since my first. And I love that it's non-judgmental and open to all scenarios. Thank you so much for your review, and I can't wait, you guys. I am so excited for this week's podcast guest, and I hope it kind of goes along with your, it's okay that you found us at 37 weeks. It's going to be great information for pregnancy, and it's going to move into your postpartum as well. So with that, I want to talk today about prenatal nutrition, specifically from a place of talking about food. And with me here, I have Lily Nichols. So I will let her take a moment. Please introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about you, kind of your background, how you got into what you do. And then we'll dive into the tons of questions that I have for women who are pregnant right now.
Yeah, sure thing. Well, thank you for having me on the show. My background is as a registered dietitian nutritionist and also a diabetes educator. And really most of my work for my career as a dietitian has been in the prenatal space, specifically with quite a bit of work in the field of gestational diabetes. But I've worn many different hats in this arena, from working in, you know, public policy level at the state of California to clinical practice, research, helping to train other professionals. And then now, of course, most people know me from my books. So I have 2 books, Real Food for Gestational Diabetes and Real Food for Pregnancy. Arguably, unless you have gestational diabetes, you probably would know me from the pregnancy one. And really the whole reason that I wrote those books is because in my work in this field, I realized there was a pretty large gap between what our guidelines for prenatal nutrition say is okay for pregnancy and what's actually optimal for both mother and baby's health during pregnancy, but also postpartum recovery and arguably this child's lifelong health as well. And so that's what I write about. And that's really what I've devoted my whole career to at this point.
Yeah, that's really neat. I know I personally, like I had said before the interview, I read the book. I have it on audiobook. For those that are listening, I also follow you on Instagram. Your blogs are incredible. I mean, if you guys are not following Lily, now is the time, particularly during pregnancy. I think you are a wealth of information. And my favorite part is obviously that it is evidence-based. You've done a ton of study research and just everything that is in the book. You're like, yes, 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 I get it. And you just have a ton of resources to go along with it, which I just love. My first question is for moms that are listening, what is the difference between asking your OB or your prenatal provider about nutrition and what you've written in the book or what you've come to find, or meeting with a registered dietitian, for example?
Yeah, you'll get a whole array of interesting answers depending on who you ask. So medical school is not really set up to cover nutrition in depth. Many medical schools have minimal or no information at all. If they do include information, it's often specifically reflective of what the dietary guidelines are. So it's very just like conventional, brief overview type information. It doesn't really get into the weeds of the specifics of nutritional biochemistry and genetic differences and even the, you know, physiology of what changes like nutrient wise over the course of pregnancy, like when and why you need more of certain nutrients, and certainly does not include some of the newer data from the last 5-10 years, much of which has suggested that our guidelines need a serious revamp to reflect some of this new data. So typically, and I'm not saying this is true of all doctors, you sometimes do find doctors and midwives who are really well informed on the topic. But oftentimes when you ask something about nutrition, you'll get a very basic answer. And with pregnancy, often the type of information that's relayed is just avoid these foods during pregnancy, don't drink alcohol, take a prenatal vitamin. You might be given like a very like a small pamphlet talking about like food groups and like portions of various foods to eat, but it's really, really like distilled down kind of elementary level information. And much of which actually is completely untrue, sadly. So like these lengthy lists of foods to avoid, I mean, I have a whole section in chapter 4 of Real Food for Pregnancy looking at the evidence for like, do you really have to avoid eggs with runny yolks? Can you really not eat lunch meat? Can you really not eat sushi? Like, those are all things that are like front and center. That's like the major thing that tends to be focused on in conventional prenatal care. And yet the evidence to support those recommendations is actually pretty flimsy. If you're seeing a dietitian, I mean, the benefit of a dietitian compared to getting nutrition information from a doctor is we have, you know, a 4-year degree in nutrition, you know, a year-long internship. At the very least, that's just like a dietitian straight out of school. Challenges, there's not a whole lot on pregnancy. In our training. So much of the work that I've done has been entirely on my own, like seeking out that information for myself, learning from being in practice, going to conferences, reading thousands and thousands of research papers. My own experience of my own two pregnancies certainly informs things as well. But really a lot of it is like on the job learning with your clients. And so the quality of information you'll get from a dietitian depends on their level of experience. Like generally they have a better handle on nutrient metabolism and like nutritional biochemistry and supplements. But if the only information they've been exposed to about prenatal nutrition is the standard of care, you might not get that much more meaty information than what you get from asking your doctor. So it really all depends on how much initiative they've taken on in their own time to really dive into prenatal nutrition. There's just, you know, it's like like any profession, there's good plumbers and bad plumbers, right? You want to like call a good one. You know, the same goes for the medical profession as well. We can't paint with broad strokes that because they have this designation, they're always really good or they're always really bad. There's just a vast array of quality of practitioners, just like any field.
Totally. I preach that all day long. But I feel like what you've done is fill a gap. And I feel like it's been a long time coming. And that's what I've enjoyed about reading the information, is a lot of it, even with what I teach, even within my birth course or what has been taught to me through other midwives or courses that I've taken. You know, we talk about, or the brewer's diet, for example, right? Like we talk about these like high protein, well-balanced diets.
Yeah.
And the best information that we've seen from that is, well, we had these two study groups and this one we didn't use the diet with, and this is what happened, and this one we did, and this is what happened. Mm-hmm. And so we can say, oh, that was a better outcome. Let's go there. But you've broken down like even throughout the like macronutrients, the why behind it. And I want to get into that in just a minute. Like the portions and percentages and why it matters, as well as the sourcing of the food, which I think is huge. And we don't talk about nutrition enough during pregnancy. The way that I teach it, for example, is it's not even just you want to be healthy and eat good. You want to be in control of the decisions for your birth. And you can do that by being healthy and low risk. And that comes from having a really solid base in nutrition. Mm-hmm. So I think that's huge. So we talk for a moment. The title of the book is Real Food for Pregnancy or Real Food for Gestational Diabetes. What is real food?
Yeah, well, and also I agree with you on all points. Goal is to be as boring of a case study as possible during pregnancy. So right. Nobody tries to, you know, risk you out of care or any other nonsense. So real food, everybody has their own definition. To me, when I'm looking at like what's actually optimal for mother and baby, I look at sort of reverse engineering a diet that provides optimal levels of vitamins and minerals. In other words, our micronutrients. So like, let's reverse engineer the most nutrient-dense diet possible. And how do you do that? You look for the most nutrient-dense foods, the ones that have the most vitamins and minerals per serving, and try to build a diet around those foods. It just so happens that the more you process things, the more you take nutrients out, typically. Not all, you know, traditional forms of processing, like fermentation, for example, have that effect. But modern day processing, like taking corn and turning it into corn syrup, or taking whole wheat grains and turning them into white flour, that has a different effect. You know, it changes the nutrient density of the food when it's gone through all of that processing. So first and foremost, real foods would be those that haven't been processed in a way that removes nutrients. I gave you a couple examples, but a couple more that people often don't think about would be like taking a whole animal and then taking everything out and only eating the muscle meat. So taking a whole chicken and the only thing you eat is the chicken breast. You're leaving behind most of the collagen-rich parts of the bird. You're certainly leaving behind the organs, which is the most nutrient-dense part of the animal, but you're getting a different nutritional profile when you're only taking out this like one little piece that could be packaged up really nicely in styrofoam and plastic wrap in the grocery store, and not eating those other parts, which our ancestors would have made use of. Same thing with like eggs, you know, eggs come with a yolk for a reason. If you take out the yolk and you're only eating the white, you're getting a different nutritional profile, and it's significantly less nutrient dense because most of the vitamins and minerals are concentrated in the yolk. So I think about real food from that perspective. We're not taking parts of the whole out and throwing things away because we don't like them because they're, quote, too high in fat or whatever conventional nutrition has told us about those foods, and we're certainly not processing them in a way that removes those foods. So, removes those nutrients rather. So what this looks like would be, you know, a diet based around whole unprocessed foods. You know, we got our fruits and vegetables and our, animal foods, meat, fish, poultry, eggs, unprocessed dairy products. And certainly there's room for other plant foods, you know, your whole grains and legumes and nuts and seeds and all that. There's room for all of these things. We're simply trying to eat them in the least processed form to give us maximum nutrient density.
Yeah. You talked about the micronutrients. Will you take a moment and talk a little more about the macronutrients specifically? You even talked about kind of like the food pyramid, for example, that we have here in the United States and the portions in which we put our carbs, proteins, fat, or what we're taught traditionally here, and why that is not correct. And I will just tell you, and for those who are listening, just from my personal experience, when I eat a diet that looks like that food pyramid, I don't feel well. And that's me, and maybe some people do, but I don't feel as well as when I increase things like proteins and good animal fats and things like that. So will you take a moment and talk about kind of the macronutrient splay and what those percentages look like, especially for pregnant moms that are listening?
Yeah, so our macronutrients are our fat, carbohydrate, and protein. They're the things that we eat to give us energy. They're kind of like structural building blocks, so to speak, whereas our micronutrients, our vitamins and minerals mostly, are needed in very small micro quantities, and they don't provide calories for us. So conventionally, our prenatal guidelines are based off of the wider population-wide guidelines, which suggests that about half of our diet comes from carbohydrates, 45 to 65%. You know, relatively small amount of protein, and no more than a third of our calories coming from fat. So that's the conventional angle. In order to meet that, you need quite a few servings of carbohydrates per day, and you need to be rather obsessive about cutting out fats out of your diet as much as possible, cooking with minimal amounts of fats and oils, taking the fat out of your dairy products, not consuming egg yolks or not many of them, fatty parts taken off of all of your animal foods, like no skin on the chicken, fat cut off the steak. If you make broth, you like skim all the fat off the broth. I mean, it's like, it's actually very hard to get your diet to less than a third of fat. So that's an important point to make, because these percentages don't mean anything to the average person, even to me, honestly, because I'm not an obsessive weigher and measurer of everything that I consume and put in my body. But I've done enough nutrient analysis to be like, oh, right, if you do manage to eat that way, that means like your entire tray of vegetables that you roasted has like one teaspoon of oil on it, which isn't even enough to coat the vegetables. Okay. Now, my opinion, and much of this is informed by the work that I've done with clients. And again, a lot of my early work was with gestational diabetes, so women who need help with blood sugar control. The guidelines recommendation on carbohydrates is way too high for blood sugar management, which, okay, you could argue that's fine and only relevant to women with blood sugar issues, but literally half of the US population has some form of diabetes or prediabetes, most of which is undiagnosed. So I would argue it's important for at least half of our pregnant clients as well. But we also have quite a bit of data on the effects of even mildly elevated blood sugar over the course of pregnancy and on mother's health, risk of complications, not just gestational diabetes, but like preeclampsia and other complications, as well as baby's lifetime metabolic health. So their risk of having blood sugar imbalance, diabetes, insulin resistance, obesity, and whatnot. So we need to really titrate the carbs down, not excessively low, but not half the diet, okay? And then we need to focus on better quality carbohydrates, which have more micronutrient density to them already, but also naturally higher fiber levels, so they don't spike our blood sugar as much. We're not going to be riding that crazy blood sugar roller coaster of highs and lows all day. So that looks like, yes, having possibly, if you're eating grains, have some whole grains, but really grains wouldn't be like the mainstay carbohydrate that you'd be eating every single meal all day long, and certainly not in large portions. You really want to focus your effort on really low glycemic carbohydrates, so ones that are fairly low in carbohydrates but high in fiber, so your non-starchy vegetables, some of your whole fruits, especially berries, legumes are a really great low glycemic source, nuts and seeds, they provide a little carbohydrate, but fiber, fat, and protein along with it to prevent that blood sugar spike. And we have quite a bit of data looking at, you know, when you focus on these nutrient-dense, low glycemic carbohydrate sources, the micronutrient intake, not surprisingly, is much better among those women. We have data both in pregnancy and in non-pregnant populations, like a low glycemic diet of higher quality carbohydrates is all around better. Then the remaining part of your diet would be coming from your protein and fat. I'm a big proponent of prioritizing protein really above pretty much anything else. That's because we now know the protein recommendations in pregnancy are a significant underestimate of what's actually optimal. They're at least 73% too low. And that data came to light only in 2015. Okay, so this is actually very recent. Our guidelines have not been updated whatsoever to reflect this information. If you want an optimally healthy pregnancy, you need a lot more protein than what your doctor or conventionally trained dietitian is telling you you need. Probably somewhere between like 25 and 30 grams of protein per meal at minimum. Now, some of that can be adjusted up or down based on your body size, activity levels, where you are in your pregnancy. A little more is needed towards the end. But that's a good general place to start. And of course, I would hope that if you're having snacks, there's also some protein snuck in there as well. When you look at the foods that are most nutrient dense and the ones that provide the most vitamins and minerals that are required during pregnancy, meaning the ones that women are often not getting enough of already, or the ones where needs increase most over the course of pregnancy, things like vitamin A, vitamin B12, iron, zinc, choline, B6, these all end up being nutrients that are found either exclusively or in highest concentrations in our protein-rich foods. So if you hit the protein targets, you're much less likely to be under-consuming many of these key nutrients. It's like a two birds with one stone situation. It just so happens that if you're not obsessive about taking fat out of every single thing you eat, and you're eating animal foods in their whole form without taking the fat out, even plant foods, like if you're having peanut butter, like don't get that weirdo powdered peanut butter defatted product. Like eat peanut butter, okay? So peanuts are supposed to have fat, right? Anyways, if you don't take all the fat out of everything obsessively and you're actually eating whole foods, not just like, you know, defatted peanut or protein powder or whatever, you're also naturally probably just going to hit your you know, minimum requirement of fat as well, and get a good amount of your fat-soluble vitamins A, D, E, and K, and all of the other, you know, good fat-soluble nutrients that you need, like DHA. So that's sort of like the brief overview, but like the ratios are just much different when you're eating in this way of prioritizing nutrient density versus eating the conventional way, where you're trying to hit these arguably very difficult to achieve macronutrient ratios. They're just very unnatural when you think about just how macronutrients are distributed in our foods. It's like impossibly hard to eat super low fat without significantly under eating your protein and under eating a lot of your essential vitamins and minerals as well.
Yeah, I think you brought up a really great point. Like even how you're talking about, if we're trying, you literally have to pull apart the foods that you're eating in order to hit those unrealistic expectations versus eating a whole food the way that it should be prepared, the way that it comes. And I think that's huge. I also think it takes a lot of the stress off of moms, or people in general. But, you know, I just think of like pregnant moms and trying to, because like you said, you know, we go into our doctor's office and they're like, yeah, here's a pamphlet, avoid these foods. Also don't gain weight, you know. now. And that's, even that's not realistic. You know, you gain what you gain. And if you're eating this healthy diet, like you're talking about, that's high in protein content and adjusted throughout pregnancy, then you gain what you gain. Some women are going to gain 15 to 20 pounds. Some will be at that, you know, 25 to 35 in the middle, and others are going to gain 60 every time. And that's where it becomes just a number depending on what your nutrition looks like. So I think it's really important that you shared that. I love too that percentage for moms that are listening that you said there's a gap of 73% of like where women are told the amount of protein they're supposed to have versus what they should be having. That's huge. And we know from studies and, you know, some of which obviously are included within this book, that women who have that really high protein diet and that good nutrition throughout pregnancy are able to avoid things like gestational diabetes or preeclampsia. And that's a big deal when we're talking about the health of mom, the health of baby. The other thing that you talked about that I think is just huge is I think, you know, we know to a certain extent that what we do affects our babies, but you're talking about details and studies and information that shows quite literally that what we're eating affects how our baby will react to food the rest of their lives, you know, predisposed to their own diabetes source, predisposed to weight gain. And I think that's huge. I think it's really important for moms to hear, because all of us who are, you know, just trying our best to grow these babies and be the best moms that we can be, we can't do that without all the good information. And that's what women are craving. You know, we want to be able to be that mother for our baby. And this is why this information is so important and so huge. Along with that, you talked about so many good things like the animal fat and the parts of the liver and, you know, using the organs and all of these things that would have been done ancestrally. I just love it. Another thing that you talked about that I think it makes easier for moms too, because I'm also a visual person, is this plate method. So you take a moment and talk about the plate method for moms that are listening and they want to follow along with these guidelines. What does that look like for them?
Yeah, sure. I think it's a really helpful just schematic for planning out a meal that isn't overly complicated, but still kind of gets you in the ballpark of what we're talking about for not only macronutrient density, but hitting your vitamin and mineral needs as well. So the plate method is not a term that I coined. Many other people have worked on various plates with, you know, food groups or macronutrients laid out in a specific way. I've personally kind of fine-tuned my own, what I feel is optimal for pregnancy and for blood sugar balance. And so that looks like approximately a quarter of your plate coming from protein, as well as the fat that's meant to be in those protein sources. About half of your plate coming from primarily non-starchy vegetables, and those should be prepared with a little bit of fat as well. And then the other quarter of your plate would be coming from more concentrated sources of carbohydrates, like starchy vegetables or fruit or legumes, arguably even milk or yogurt, because they have lactose, tend to fit into that category. Although there are some specifics on if you're eating like Greek yogurt or cheese, which are actually very low carb and would fit in the protein category. But ultimately, giving you a visual, so if you have, say, a salmon salad or something, you know, your salad greens would take up at least half the plate. You'd have a good serving of protein on there, maybe 4 to 6 ounces of salmon, or, you know, more or less depending on your protein needs specifically. And then probably a carbohydrate source along with it. I do give room to customize your carbohydrate needs based on your own personal carbohydrate tolerance. Some people do better with more, some people do better with less. So that's up to you to kind of figure out. And I talk about how to figure out which category you might fit in. But that may look like having a half to one cup of a concentrated carbohydrate source. That could be like roasted sweet potatoes, it could be rice, it could be legumes, it could be cooked winter squash, it could be a large serving of fruit, maybe. But some carbohydrates in there. And by having this combination of macronutrients and food groups, you naturally are going to avoid a really large blood sugar spike at a meal. I just want to contrast this with, like, possibly I should have given a breakfast example because that's the best meal to make this comparison. But since I chose salmon and salad and whatever, I'll just run with that. Say the alternative is a meal of pasta, right? A typical meal of pasta, say you're having pasta and meatballs. Pasta is often served in a really large portion. You might have 2 cups or more of noodles. Most people don't realize that by the way that our nutrition guidelines are written, a portion of so-called portion of carbohydrates, I'm using quotations for those listening, is like minuscule. Okay. It's like laughably small. It's like a third to a half cup of pasta. Okay. So this, like, when you're having, you know, a whole bowl of pasta, that's probably the equivalent of like 4 servings of carbohydrates by a dietitian's breakdown of your meal, even though to you, that's like just a serving of pasta. Okay. So that is the majority of your plate. And then you might like plunk a couple little meatballs on there. So might not be getting enough protein. And then some tomato sauce, which sure that, you know, provides some vegetables. You have your tomatoes and onions, hopefully. Depends on the quality of the sauce. Some are just, you know, totally full of sugar. But the ratios are all off. It's like, yeah, there's a little vegetables and yeah, there's a little protein, but really the majority of the plate is starch or carbohydrates. And the effect on your blood sugar is pretty intense when you have a whole big plate of just pasta or a whole big plate of just rice. Even worse is sometimes people have a whole bowl of noodles and there's no protein on there whatsoever, right? So you could tweak that meal and still make it work by having a relatively small portion of pasta. Maybe you mix it with some zucchini noodles or something, or just have a small portion of pasta and a big side of like cooked broccoli or a salad or green beans or whatever. Give yourself a more sizable portion of the meatballs and yes, have your typical sauce and, you know, Parmesan cheese or whatever. And the effect of that meal where you're incorporating sort of the plate method concept would be much gentler on your blood sugar levels. So you can apply it to really any meal, any mix of foods.
Yeah, I like that. The other thing it makes me think of is that thought just went right out the window. I guess it doesn't make me think of anything.
It doesn't make you think of anything. Blank slate. That makes my brain just go blank.
Okay. I know what I was going to ask. Sorry. The other thing I wanted to ask you real quick is I know even as I was reading or I'm listening, you know, what about feeling full? What about this, like, the satiation, you know, that comes with like carbs? I feel overly full, you know, but I definitely feel full for a time. What would you say to moms that are curious about that, where you're like, high proteins, just a little bit of these things? Do you feel full?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm a big fan of mindful eating. So you can try out various ratios of carbs to protein to fat to vegetables at your meals and see what works for you. For me, for example, if I have a meal that is really heavy on the carbs but low on protein, oatmeal is a good example of that for me personally. I'll feel overly full, like disgustingly full, like there's a brick in my stomach for half hour, maybe hour and a half, and then suddenly be absolutely famished and starving and need to eat right away. So carbohydrates do often give us that bulk, which gives us the sensation of being full, but they're digested really quickly. They give us a big blood sugar spike and a big blood sugar crash, and then we are starving. Like, it's like that feeling where you have to eat like immediately. And I can speak to this because I spent like at least the first 20 years of my life living in a cycle of reactive hypoglycemia, blood sugar spikes and crashes and like needing food. Not realizing, I mean, I can look back now, I was simply overeating carbohydrates and way under eating protein. Protein and fat, but protein especially, is arguably the most satiating nutrient of all. Without taking up a whole bunch of space in our stomach. So the sensation of fullness may be different than a meal that's high carbohydrate. Like you might reach a point of I am full and don't have the urge to eat any more food without having this sensation of your stomach feeling like kind of bloated, I guess would be the best way to describe it. I don't know if bloating is the best thing, but you don't get the feeling of uncomfortable fullness from a full serving of protein. You simply lose the desire to continue eating. So play around with it because we're all different. I do know some people when they go try to go say full on like keto, like I'm actually not great doing full keto. Like I do well with kind of a low moderate intake of carbohydrates. If I don't have any carbohydrates at the meal, I can feel like I'm not satiated, like I need a little bit. So I've kind of found my sweet spot. There's other people who really thrive with pretty low intake of carbohydrates, but maybe they're getting the majority of their carbohydrates from those non-starchy vegetables, like, you know, green beans or broccoli or salad or something like that. But play around with your experience of satiety and fullness. And I would look beyond just the immediate feeling of fullness. Check in at, you know, every half hour or hour after the meal. Think about when your appetite starts to return, you get that sort of gnawing feeling that you want to eat again or feel a drop in your energy levels, and see where that hits for you. In an ideal world, a meal would keep us full for at least several hours. Sometimes in pregnancy, you know, nothing is textbook perfect. And there's, you know, you have like nausea phase, which is its own kind of hot mess. And then you have towards the end of pregnancy, some of them actually have a lessened appetite. They just don't have the room to fit the food in their stomach because it's so smashed and compressed by their uterus that the idea of having like three large meals and no snacks like often just does not work at all towards the end of pregnancy. You kind of just have to sort of graze your way through the day. So meals might not keep you full for several hours in in late pregnancy, simply because you can't fit a full meal in at a time. You kind of have to break it up. So, but speaking about, you know, outside of pregnancy, or maybe in that sweet spot of the second trimester when everything sounds good and you can eat normal sized portions, a meal really should keep you full and fairly energized for a few hours before you need to eat again. And if you're getting to the point where you're just like completely famished and like must find anything to eat, you've either undereaten at the previous meal, have gone too long without eating, or maybe that macronutrient balance at the previous meal was a little bit off. And usually if it's getting to that point, I typically see that's from the underconsumption of protein and fat and overconsumption of carbohydrate at that prior meal.
Yeah, that's great. I like the idea of, you know, we're individuals and that what works for some might not work for another, and being able to kind of play with that with, you know, making protein probably the highest on your list to make sure that you get enough of that. So thank you for kind of explaining that. Really quick before we go, I did want to ask, because I know moms are curious. I have several moms that follow along that are vegetarian. What advice do you have for moms that don't eat meat when they're looking for good sources of protein and being able to maintain those macronutrients that you're talking about?
Yeah, it's a little bit trickier on a vegetarian diet, but it can be doable. If we're assuming that a person is a lacto-ovo vegetarian, so they also consume dairy and eggs, that's easier to achieve because you have eggs and dairy products. You know, the benefit of eggs and dairy products from a macronutrient perspective being eggs are high protein, no carbohydrate. And some of our dairy products like Greek yogurt, cottage cheese, they're high protein and very low carbohydrate. Whereas the rest of our plant-based sources of protein, which would otherwise make up the rest of the diet, they all come packaged with carbohydrate. So naturally, when you look at the macronutrient breakdown of a typical vegetarian, particularly for vegans, carbohydrate intake is often quite high, 55-60% of calories, whereas protein intake is often quite low, usually coming in at around 12% of calories, which is probably getting borderline a little too low for what we're looking for for pregnancy. I prefer to look at protein in like a gram amount, but most of these studies are looking at percentages of protein. So that's the easiest way for me to talk about it, because the actual gram amount would be relative to the amount of food and calories a person is consuming. So what I would recommend in that case would be to prioritize having some eggs and some dairy products if you eat those things, not just from the protein perspective, but from amino acid balance, as well as the micronutrient content. So in a vegetarian, for example, the only vitamin B12 sources other than fortified foods and supplements that they would be taking in would be the egg yolks and their dairy products. That becomes a pretty important source of nutrients for them. Eggs would be the major source of choline coming in the diet, which we didn't talk about. That's a B vitamin-like compound that's important for many different functions, from placental function, liver function, brain health, baby's brain and eye development, prevention of pregnancy complications. It's a really valuable, important nutrient. So just from a micronutrient perspective of filling in the gaps, those are really helpful to have on board. And then the remainder of your protein would be coming from whatever vegetarian sources you're already consuming. So you got your legumes, your nuts and seeds, and then all of your, typically legume or grain-based vegetarian meat replacement products, for example. And there's quite a few different ones out there these days. I just recently heard about one called Pumfu, which is like a tofu, but it's made from pumpkin seeds. You know, there's a lot of different cool options. Certainly, like when it comes to soy, that tends to be a major source of calories for a typical vegetarian or vegan. And if that's a major source of protein for you, I'd be prioritizing, you know, organic and fermented soy sources. So you're minimizing your exposure to pesticide residues and also increasing your nutrient bioavailability from those foods. So like an organic tempeh would be a good example of something that could be incorporated. There's also vegetarian protein powders. And I think pregnancy would be a place where that would make sense for somebody not otherwise getting a whole lot of protein. Not just like, you know, they have like rice protein and pea protein and whatnot, but there's, if you're eating eggs or dairy products, you could do like an egg white protein or a grass-fed whey protein, for example. That can often help flip that balance just a little bit on the macros, so it's not as heavy on the carbohydrates, because that's where it gets tricky. If you're trying to sort of balance all of it out, so you're eating like lots and lots of legumes for your protein intake, you're also vastly ramping up the carbohydrate intake, and there you might have to choose to eat fewer grains or fewer potatoes or fewer fruit to try to keep that protein intake high, right? So just a couple things to keep in mind. I do have a section on vegetarian diets and pregnancy in chapter 3 of Real Food for Pregnancy, most of which is a focus on the micronutrient considerations. And there are some special supplement considerations as well. So I highly recommend checking out that part of the book if you fall in that category.
Yeah, that's great. I've actually had women who are vegetarian or vegan who have chose to eat meat just during their pregnancy for some of the reasons that you mentioned, just the difficulty in getting to the amount of protein or those macronutrients that they're really aiming to do. So definitely great information to be able to consider. You had some other things in your book, and you guys, again, for those who are listening, she's got the Gestational Diabetes book as well. So we didn't get into that today. I feel like that's a whole other topic, a whole other podcast topic, and just great information there. But along with everything that we've talked about, which were kind of like excerpts from your book, you go over meal plans, you talk about supplements, screenings and testing that moms can have done during pregnancy. You even include recipes in your book. Is there anything that you feel like would be really useful for moms to know right now that like, hey, this information is either in the book or if you're looking for XYZ, like head here, that really stands out to you for moms that are listening that are pregnant right now?
Well, I think I always have to give a plug to postpartum recovery, because we put so much emphasis on nutrition in pregnancy, and then there's really not a lot of information out there on what to eat postpartum. So just to give one little plug, since we've been talking about pregnancy the whole time, your nutrient needs are actually higher postpartum than they are during pregnancy, especially in that early phase, the first couple months, arguably the first 6 months to a year, but nonetheless, your nutrient needs are higher as you're recovering from birth and as your body heals and transitions to producing breast milk. Even if you're not breastfeeding or not breastfeeding for long, though, there's still a lot to recover because your body has been expending nutrients for 9 months. You're never going to end your pregnancy more nutrient replete than when you started your pregnancy. As they say, like, baby will take from you anything it needs, which is true. certainly if you're starting with higher nutrient stores and you've been eating a really nutrient dense diet during pregnancy, you can offset some of those losses because you've been actively trying to keep up over the course of pregnancy. But that same idea of eating nutrient-dense foods should continue postpartum as well. So there's a whole chapter in Real Food for Pregnancy on the fourth trimester on postpartum recovery. Keep in mind, I started writing this book when my firstborn was 10 months old. So I was still right in the throes of postpartum recovery and could actively relate to how hungry you are when you're breastfeeding, and really how much it takes to heal well. In addition to that, I do have a blog article on my website called Real Food Postpartum Recovery Meals. So if you don't have the book, at the very least, please read that article before you have your baby and take some time to think about how you will rest, recover, and receive support. And part of that is nourishment, thinking about how you will be nourished, because you're probably not going to be in a physical or mental state to be up and about and cooking. So traditionally, we had family members that we either lived with or came to live with us who cooked for us and heated up food for us. And like, our job was just to rest and recover and feed our baby. Nowadays, it's like you're just on your own, especially in Western culture. There's not a big focus on this. So you kind of have to do some groundwork ahead of time. You don't have to, but I could tell you, you will be glad you did. If you take that time to prep and have some, you know, either freezer meals stocked or some sort of a contingency plan for friends and family members bringing you meals, delivered meals, whatever it takes. But that article is a really good place to go for more of like the practical implementation of what I'm talking about in chapter 12, the fourth trimester chapter of Real Food for Pregnancy.
That's great. We will make sure to include that link in the show notes as well, so you can head directly to Lily's page for all that information. And on that note, will you let them know where they can find you, information about you, connect with you?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can find me at lilynicholsrdn.com. That's where my blog is with all those articles. I also give away the first chapter of Real Food for Pregnancy for free there. So if you need a little more, you know, understanding, like in black and white, what am I talking about with conventional prenatal nutrition? What am I talking about with real food? Included in that free chapter is a sample meal plan breakdown of a conventional one and one of mine, and the nutrient analysis showing you what are the levels of vitamins and minerals, how does it compare? And you can see in black and white what I'm talking about just with that one chart and table alone. In addition to that, there, you know, you can find where my books are sold on my site. And then social media wise, I'm most active these days on Instagram. So my handle's the same as my website, LilyNicholsRDN.
Well, thank you so much for everything that you've done. I'm grateful that you've been able to be here and talk with my audience, but even more so than that, I'm grateful for the time and attention that you've put into gathering information and writing it in such a simple way that anyone can read it and be able to take that information and use it during their pregnancy and postpartum period. So thank you so much for everything you've done.
That's it for this week, but make sure you subscribe to the podcast so that you get notifications first as I drop new episode every week. And don't forget to head over to myessentialbirth.com for all of the free downloads mentioned here and to join the birth course and community serving pregnant moms just like you. If you enjoyed this and other episodes, I would love it if you would take a few minutes to leave a review on Apple Podcasts. I read every single one and include one at the beginning of each episode. See you next week.